A Map of the World, Disc 14.
Although Howard insisted that the case was over the second day of testimony, that Susan Dirks's primary witnesses cut their own throats, I knew he was only trying to be helpful, that there wasn't sound basis for relief. What I had been worrying over in particular was the fact that earlier in the summer, Rafferty had lost his motion to suppress the admission I'd made to the investigators. He had argued that I should have been read my rights that night of the school board meeting, that I was actually a suspect, that I was being interrogated rather than questioned. Mrs. Dirks maintained that I had been free to leave, as in fact I did, that I had not been forcibly detained, and that therefore there had been no legal requirement to read me my rights. When Mrs. Dirks, in her impassioned opening statement at the trial, made reference to my confession, Rafferty objected with his finger, the way a seasoned bidder makes himself known at an auction. "Objection, Your Honor. Will the word confession please be struck from the record?" In her mauve linen jacket and white wool skirt, black high heels and a smoky gray silk shirt, she was far more beguiling than Rafferty could ever hope to be, even if he replaced his cheap plaid suit coat with something more fashionable. At the very start, she advised the jurors that where there is sexual abuse, there is often no physical evidence. "When we are listening to a child testify," she instructed, "we must listen very carefully. It is not necessary to believe everything a child says. We must take into consideration the details, but in abuse cases, we must also listen for the emotional truth in the child's telling." Rafferty objected, and the judge slowly rubbed his mouth from side to side before he declared that Mrs. Dirks should continue. When it was his turn to speak, Rafferty explained to the jury that Mrs. Dirks had as good as advised them to forget certain democratic values, values such as the critical importance of the evidence in a criminal trial. He asked them if they could suspend their belief in the Constitution. He said that historically, we were a society that seemed to go through a self-cleansing exercise every 50 years, and that the jurors were witnessing just such an exercise, that similar cases were going on all over the United States. Dirks objected, and the judge informed Rafferty that he was out of line, using closing argument material. It was all such a far cry from my office at Blackwell Elementary, so far from the day I slapped Robbie and he stared back at me, seemingly unaffected. "Mrs. Dirks told you," Rafferty said, "that my client made an admission. But what she hasn't told you is the circumstance and the context. Fortunately, I am here to tell you more about my client's statements, to draw a complete picture. Thank goodness I will be able to give you the all-important context, ladies and gentlemen. The context." I took in the jury with sidelong glances. There was a pair that intrigued me. One, a stout woman with jowls and a mouth that had petrified into a scowl. And the other, a gray-green, tall, thin lady with penciled eyebrows, arched in perpetual wonder. Both of them had identical blonde beehives, nominal hair teased up into the magnificent fluff of what looked like cotton candy. They sat next to each other, the one surly, the other astonished, thinking, "What?" I longed to be ridiculous, to sing to them, "Beautiful soup, beautiful soup, soup of the evening, beautiful, beautiful soup." Next to them sat a young man who stocked dairy products at a grocery store, perhaps a soulmate of ours, in love with yogurt, cheese, butter, cream, eggnog. There was an aging hippie with white hair flowing down his back, the face of a Greek god, and eyes that looked from a distance as if they were golden. He climbed telephone poles for a living, and I imagined him with a house full of colored glass insulators, his wife in despair at the collection that was growing beyond their storage capacity. Robbie was the first to take the stand. Again, he sat on his mother's lap. He'd lost a front tooth, so that in some ways he looked more childlike than he had before. I wondered how he'd spent the last several months, how it felt going to first grade as the little boy who'd nearly been done in by the school nurse. His mother was exquisitely sad, her luster slightly faded, though nothing that couldn't be polished up at a moment's notice, brought back to its former gloss and shine. It was my fate being decided, and yet the words of the hallowed court fell away as I watched the darling gestures mother made, the tilt of her head, her little caresses, the smallest kiss at his ear after they were excused. She herself seemed to me like some golden, steaming, delectable, irresistible potion that is held out, that one is urged to drink, drink. And only when the liquid has irretrievably slipped down the throat does one know what one has drunk. I couldn't help thinking of her in immoderate terms. Rafferty's protestations didn't in any way move the judge to order Mrs. Mackesy down from the witness box. Robbie had grown up enough so that he no longer required the doll to demonstrate my torture. His long, serious face and the baby language he used for his private parts didn't match. The words were those that Miss Flint had perhaps suggested. Against his glimmering mother, he was nearly invisible. But what I saw was a tired boy, someone who looked as if he didn't want to play anymore. He was going through the motions, but it was as if he could hardly muster the energy to do much damage. When Mrs. Dirks requested a recess until the following morning, due to the witness's apparent fatigue, the judge, to our amazement, rumbled that we were all tired, that we'd all been waiting, that the thing had been postponed twice, and that we had to move along. He granted her 30 minutes for rest. Out at the far end of the hall, during the break, Rafferty hugged his appointment book and simpered. He likes me. Judge Peterson really likes me. Howard was standing by the water cooler, and when he heard Rafferty, he turned and gave him a withering look, the sort that makes a person feel that it might have been better not to be born. I hadn't realized before just how very capable Howard was of conveying disdain. The judge is on our side this time, Rafferty said, taking fast sips of hot coffee, oblivious to my husband's disgust. He's going to let it go wide open for us. That's my sense. Robbie more than fulfilled Rafferty's hopes during the cross-examination. Rafferty stood with his arms bent, his hands clasped at his chest. He asked Robbie ever so gently the most probing and occasionally indelicate questions. More than once, he said, with a lush softness, "You didn't say that at the preliminary hearing, Rob." Rafferty only grew more kind as the boy glowered and shouted. My first-rate criminal lawyer displayed the paternal care that had drawn me to him in the first place. For an hour, he questioned the boy, repeatedly asking him about the material of his pants. Who unbuttoned them? Did he have a belt? Was there a snap at the waist and a zipper? Robbie became so irritated partway through that the judge ordered another short break. Close to the end of the questioning, Rafferty said, "Did you have a neighbor when you lived on 372 Main Street, Robbie, in your old house? A kid by the name of Jack Sheridan?" Robbie said, "So?" "Jack was a little bit older than you, wasn't he?" "I don't know." "Mrs. Sheridan didn't babysit you, I know that, but she looked out for you, didn't she?" He shrugged. "She came to your house once, on May 23rd last spring, just before school was out. Do you remember that night?" Anyone who had watched Robbie before would have known that he was thinking. He didn't move or blink. It was impossible to say if he was wondering how to respond or if the question had carried him back in time. Mrs. Sheridan came to your door. She asked if Jack was at your house. You wanted her to come in to see something. You had something to show her. Mrs. Mackesy shrank into her chair. It was as if she faded away, as if her lights went out. Her boy came into focus, the dark circles under his eyes, his unnerving stare, his unhealthy complexion, his skin pale and taut as the hide over a drum. There, the jury must see, was a sick boy. The blonde beehive of the taller juror was bobbing with her touch of Parkinson's, and she had such wide, wondering eyes, she seemed to be willing herself to stay awake. Mrs. Dirks was objecting loudly and asking for an offer of proof. The two lawyers and Judge Peterson trooped into the inner sanctum. After several minutes, they returned, and Rafferty continued his line of questioning. Mrs. Sheridan came to your house on May 23rd, Robbie, and you told her you had something to show her. Is that something you remember? He didn't answer, which Rafferty noted to the court reporter. Is that something that you don't want to talk about? Still no answer. It was just getting dark that night, and you said she had to come look in the den. Do you remember that, pal? Rafferty quietly asked that it be entered into the record that the witness sat expressionless and refused to respond. Later he asked, wasn't Mrs. Goodwin's job, her main job, to give you medicine when you were sick? No. Did Mrs. Goodwin ever give you medicine when you visited her in your office? No. You never got Suprax, that yellow medicine which comes from a bottle and tastes like strawberry syrup? You never got that medicine from Mrs. Goodwin? I said no. Were you scared when you showed Mrs. Sheridan in the den? There was no music in the courtroom after all. Nothing but questions, shouts from Mrs. Dirks, the tired judge paving the way for justice. The one time I looked at Susan Dirks, she had her entire bottom lip drawn into her mouth and looked to be biting down fairly hard. Her pen was between her second and third finger, and she was beating it on her notepad. Did Mrs. Goodwin give you your medicine with a spoon? Yeah. She gave you that yellow stuff, Suprax, with a spoon? Yeah. So sometimes you went to her office and she gave you your medicine. Stop asking me that, Robbie cried. You're so boring. You hurt me when you're that boring. I'm hurting you? I said you're hurting me. There was a hush over the room. No further questions, Your Honor, Rafferty said, after a decent interval. Over the noon hour, Howard and I sat by the lake in the cold, and I wondered out loud what the jurors were eating, and were they bonding over their boxed lunches, and had the leader already emerged. I tried to flesh out the few I'd taken an interest in, tried to imagine their home life. But Howard wasn't listening. If I said much more, he would ask me how I could be detached at a time like this. And I'd have to say that if I thought about the trial too hard, I'd be so nervous I'd have to consider drastic alternatives. I'd be seriously tempted to flee. There was among the jurors a woman with graying, curly hair and half glasses who always seemed to be paying attention, who looked intelligent. Perhaps she would be the one to guide the group to an informed decision. Howard and I had ham and cheese sandwiches, which we ate in the bitter wind. We passed the thermos back and forth, clutching the cylinder for the last warmth of the coffee. We were out of sync with our surroundings, having the kind of picnic people have when they are in love. When it's worth braving the cold. When you're so happy you don't notice the stale bread or the temperature of the drink. I stopped talking, and we ate, watching the gulls. Mrs. Dirks called the child protection worker that first afternoon. Myra Flint was a broad woman with a turned-up nose, nothing like Mrs. Mackesy to feast our eyes upon. She clumped to the witness box in blue clogs, the noise of which somehow penetrated the carpet. A good deal of her testimony was about interviewing techniques she had used to elicit Robbie's confession. The technical nature of the questions may have disappointed those few observers who had hoped for the lurid stuff of TV dramas, but I found that I could fasten on her, that for the most part I could follow the concrete and suffocatingly tedious and repetitive questions and answers. The judge had to reprimand one of the jurors, an older man, because he was snoring. Children's memories, Myra Flint explained, can become locked inside their minds. One possible key to unlocking those memories is to ask very specific questions, or even leading questions. In the legal context, of course, we aren't allowed to do so. Consequently, one set of techniques I use provides children with retrieval strategies and cues, while at the same time steering clear of leading questions. The cognitive interview is a technique I use on older children, but with some modifications, it is also useful on someone Robbie's age. Context reinstatement, Myra droned on, is another technique I use when appropriate for improving children's recall. Taking a child back to the scene of an event helps to reinstate, if you will, the child's memory.
So you helped him, didn't you? Rafferty asked at the start of a series of questions. Spent quite a lot of time with him. In fact, this is how you make your living, in part, helping children to recall.
It can be a long process, Mr. Rafferty, helping children through the trauma of abuse.
It takes many sessions to enhance their memories?
That is not what I said.
In fact, isn't it fair to say that oftentimes it is your work that allows someone like Robbie to recall enough to allow him to testify at all?
He was always hinting at, but never asking the question, without your work, Ms. Flint, Robbie is like a ventriloquist dummy?
Isn't it right that without your skill in memory enhancement, children wouldn't be able to come up with the specifics necessary for believable testimony?
The accusations had been shocking in the beginning, but they had lost their sting the second time around. The details seemed flat, without meaning. I tried again to think what the trial was actually about. I had thought that it was about hate, pure, undiluted hatred, hate for the joyous sake of hatred. But I wasn't sure anymore. It was peculiar that I couldn't very well remember how Robbie used to affect me. We are told when we are growing up that hate is a strong word, that we should save it for the despicable things in life. In quantifying my feelings for Robbie, I had to strain to remember back all those months, to gauge the intensity of my anger as he came scraping along the hall. He'd stand at the door, staring me down. He always looked as if he knew full well that he had far more knowledge than was appropriate or good for him. I used to try to keep in mind that I hated what had made him foul-mouthed and cold-hearted. But I remember the sinking feeling I had when he appeared in the doorway of my office, the feeling that there wasn't anything beyond him in the moment to hate. Now those violent sensations were no longer with me. He had made me feel small and empty. In a way, it was an immense relief to know that a boiling rage could leave one, that emotions were temporary, that they could chase away like rats scurrying down the gangplank, evacuating the ship.
Myra was an able and committed therapist who clearly cared about the children she treated. She was convinced from Robbie's acute symptoms of post-traumatic stress syndrome, from his reporting to his mother and to herself, that he had been sexually abused by the school nurse. In the cross-examination, she didn't let Rafferty rattle her. She never became belligerent or wary or defensive, although the temptation must have been considerable. When Rafferty asked, "Isn't it true that all children lie at times?" she said, "Yes, of course. Adults do, too. Children, however, generally lie to get out of trouble rather than into trouble." "Isn't it true that Robbie is a known liar, Miss Flint?" "I am well aware that he has had problems at school. It is all the more important that Robbie be assessed by experienced clinicians who are trained to tease out truths from falsehoods." "Isn't it possible for lies to become set in concrete as a child repeats them, so that a child believes the lie to be true?" "Yes, indeed, for children and adults." She went on to discuss how the clinical data in Robbie's case included his spontaneity, his sexual knowledge, and the fact that he didn't retell his stories in a rigid manner, which would have suggested rote memory. "Would you say that young children have active fantasy lives, Miss Flint?" "Yes, often." "Isn't it possible that this accusation of sexual abuse is nothing more than wishful thinking or a fantasy based on a sexual scene from television or parental behavior?" "I would say, Mr. Rafferty, that that is an unlikely interpretation. Fantasies tend to be oriented toward positive experiences. Very few children or adults daydream about being assaulted. Fantasy is directed toward solving problems, not creating them, which is certainly what happens when an allegation is made." "What, Miss Flint, do actuarial studies prove about the frequency of sexual fantasies and abuse in young children?" "I haven't recently read up on actuarial studies on that subject, Mr. Rafferty. I'd be happy to go over the evaluation of Robbie specifically and tell you again what I discovered about his fantasies and how they fit with the overall clinical picture." She wasn't behaving the way Rafferty would have liked. Although she wasn't charming or attractive, she was never evasive or defensive. Her sensible skirt and sweater, her short, easy-to-care-for hair, her sturdy frame, everything about her, except her clogs, suggested sound judgment. He later tried to trip her up when he questioned her about anatomically detailed dolls. "Isn't it true that many different anatomically detailed dolls are manufactured?" "Yes, it is," she said. "Isn't it also fair to say that the anatomical detail in the doll, the design and sexual nature, differs markedly from one manufacturer to another?" "Yes." "Are there published and accepted standardized procedures for using anatomically detailed dolls?" "None exist that I know of," she answered. "And it's just for that reason, that standardized procedures aren't available, that interviews using anatomically detailed dolls call for experienced clinicians who know how to be objective and who, over the years, have developed practical norms." "Isn't it true," Rafferty persisted, "that the board of the American Psychological Association has determined that these dolls cannot be considered standardized assessment tools?" She pushed her hair behind her ears with both hands before she began to answer. "There are indeed experts who have criticized the dolls as inaccurate tools that lead to false conclusions of child sexual abuse. However,
The statement written last year by the American Psychological Association's Committee on Children, Youth, and Families judged that doll-centered assessments may be the best practical solutions in the hands of competent psychologists and social workers. How many articles have you written for professional or scientific journals? None. Not even one in any journal anywhere? That's right. While some of my coworkers spend their careers writing for publications, my focus has been on helping and evaluating people. You are not a medical doctor, is that correct? As I told the court, I have a master's in social work. Have you had graduate-level courses in memory and perception? I've not had formal courses on those subjects, Mr. Rafferty, but every social worker is required to take psychology courses, classes which stress the fundamental role those factors play in people's lives. Have you ever misdiagnosed a client, Miss Flint? A medical doctor can look at an X-ray and be sure that the diagnosis is a broken arm. Evaluating people for emotional trauma does not always produce a neat diagnosis. I understand that. Have you ever had a client, a child, who you thought had been sexually abused and then later recanted? Yes, I have, Mr. Rafferty. Some of your colleagues believed that you had so aggressively questioned the girl she confessed the abuse in order to placate you. Objection, Susan Dirks called. Could you give us a profile, Rafferty later asked, of a character-disturbed or unattached child that a social worker such as yourself would find in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and in the book called High Risk, Children Without a Conscience? I'm not familiar with that second publication. I don't know the comprehensive list by heart, Mr. Rafferty, but some of the symptoms an unattached child might exhibit are self-destructive behaviors, the inability to give and receive affection, various types of learning disorders. Isn't also included in that list a particular pathological type of lying, primary process lying, I believe it is called? Possibly. As well as abnormalities in eye contact, cruelty to others, a lack of long-term friends. I haven't recently studied the list in depth. To refresh your memory, manipulative behaviors, phoniness, superficial attractiveness, and friendliness with strangers are also included as symptoms. Again, I haven't studied the list lately. Would you like to review it? She looked over the sheet he handed to her. Did it cross your mind as you examined Robbie that he had some of those characteristics I just mentioned? That he was manipulating you and his mother? No, it did not, Mr. Rafferty. Did it ever occur to you that he might have the profile of the character-disturbed child? Most definitely not. Did you interview Robbie's mother? No. Did you not think it might be important to interview the child's primary caretaker? In a case where a child reveals abuse, the child is our focus. Keep your chin up, Rafferty said during the break. We're doing great. He was whacking his letter opener against his pant leg. Heard anything from the girls over in the jail? He was someone who didn't often make small talk or show signs of nervousness. Perhaps Myra Flint hadn't been as pliant as he'd hoped. I reached over and touched his hand to still him. Keep your chin up, Paul, I said. Howard and I drove home without saying too much the first afternoon of the trial. When we parked the car outside of the daycare center, Howard lingered in the driver's seat, absently knocking the keychain against the steering wheel.
I put my head back, knowing he would say something worth hearing. "I wish," he began. I waited for him to develop the thought, and when, after a few minutes, I could no longer hold out, I said, "What? What do you wish?" Why couldn't he have been the one to drown? He might as well have. He might be better off if he died. "Robbie, you mean? Why have we let this go on?" The questioning was the devil's version of Simon Says. Rafferty baited Robbie and then trapped him. There must have been something we could have done to keep that poor kid from getting slaughtered. "I know," I said. "I felt that all along, that he is the one who will suffer more than anyone, more in a way than we have. I still have music and words, our children. Rafferty is... I've never met someone before who made me sick, who made me think I was going to vomit." "I have to get Claire," I said, "or they'll charge us for the next hour." "You never listen to me," he muttered. "Did you know that?" "Howard," I said, "I am listening. I just don't know what else to say. Robbie didn't drown. Lizzie did. If not Rafferty, who? Maybe I should have copped a plea and served a sentence, and then we wouldn't have had a trial. But that didn't seem the right thing to do. Not for me, and not for us in the long run. I could say I'm sorry for the rest of my life, every day, every minute for the rest of my life, and it still wouldn't exhaust all the sorriness I have inside me. I'm sorry for Lizzie most of all. I'm sorry for Robbie. I'm sorry for Teresa. I'm especially sorry on your account and for Emma and Claire. I'm sorry specifically, and I'm just plain sorry. I'm sorry Rafferty makes you sick. Maybe, just maybe, he'll get me off, and then we can somehow try to begin all over, or back in the middle, or go forward from this ending place." He stayed in the car, clicking his keychain against the steering wheel while I went for Claire. We drove back to Spring Grove, picked up Emma at the school after care program, went to the A&W, had the salad bar and bacon burgers, which even Emma had grown tired of, and finally made our way home. Many of the Pheasant Glade units hadn't been sold, and the few that had been set aside for rentals hadn't been snatched up either. The two blocks of apartments had the feel of a ghost town, particularly at night. By the time we left it, it had begun to fill up, but we often felt, coming home, that we were driving into a place where nobody else wanted to be. All those nights during the trial, we'd eat out or scratch up a supper, put the girls in the whirlpool tub, tuck them into bed, and then, because there didn't seem to be anything we could talk about, nothing to say until we knew one way or the other, I'd rearrange the cupboards or play solitaire, until I figured Howard was upstairs fast asleep. On the third day of testimony for the prosecution, David Henskin, the principal at Blackwell Elementary, and Robbie's teacher, Mrs. Ritter, both took the stand. It seemed a ridiculous exercise, both of them saying that I was sullen, that I was somehow sinister. Rafferty protesting at every turn, valiantly trying to keep character assassination out of the evidence. I was wearing an old quilt jacket I'd made years ago, and a green corduroy skirt, which Rafferty had the nerve to pronounce bookish and eccentric. "Don't wear it again, all right?" he ordered. Mrs. Ritter said that she realized now, with hindsight, that Robbie was always disturbed after he'd been to see me, that his artwork was violent, that his behavior was problematic only in relation to his visits to me. As an aside, she mentioned that she frequently saw me out in the hall doing some kind of strange dance. She had always had such faith in the staff of Blackwell Elementary, she said, and she had never thought to suspect any of the employees. Rafferty didn't bother to cross-examine her because he thought her worthless. He explained that the jury would think so, too, when they saw that he would not dignify her by asking a single question. He had had a floor plan of the school blown up to fit an easel so that the office spaces were visible. With his pointer, he took Mr. Henskin through the various hallways and offices, asking as he went, "Did Henskin often leave his own door open to encourage students and teachers to seek him out? Did the secretary leave her door open? He rarely had to use the intercom, she was so close." His schedule was varied and unpredictable, wasn't it? Did he have to leave his office to solve a problem in another part of the school? Several times a day? And when he so frequently left his office, he walked right past or even through the nurse's office? Rafferty had told me that the jurors would ask themselves how in the hell the abuse had taken place with Henskin in and out a dozen times a day. After Paul had gotten his point across, he said, "There has been a great deal of publicity about sexual abuse in the last decade. Have you ever been concerned yourself about being accused of sexual molestation?" "It's something that crosses your mind as an educator. I think anyone who works in this climate with children is aware of what care must be taken." "What climate are you speaking of?" "People are sensitive to the issue of child abuse." "It is a climate where anyone on your staff could be charged with abuse?" "We have an excellent staff at our school, overall." "I agree, your staff has always been excellent. But my question to you, sir, is given the climate, as you say, a sex abuse charge is a real fact of life for any of the district's employees, and yourself included." "Any person who works with children has to be exemplary." "Because of the hysterical climate?" "Objection," Susan Dirk shouted. Rafferty rephrased the question. "Would you say, Mr. Henskin, that an employee at your school has to be beyond reproach because there is a heightened awareness about sexual abuse?"
"Yes, I'd say so."
"And a fear about sexual abuse?"
"There is new general knowledge that child abuse is pervasive in our culture."
"Would you say that many parents are afraid for their children?"
"I couldn't say specifically, but I suppose that's true."
I scanned the jury, trying to see if they were getting the idea that they, too, could be accused. The Greek god had been wearing Hawaiian shirts all week, in spite of the fact that it was December. I dressed in particular for him every morning, wondering if he would think better of me if I was wearing the pink sweater or the blue cotton shirt. In addition to the blonde beehive ladies, there were two other older women who had become individuals as the week wore on. Grace and Betty, I called them. The type of women who went home to put on their aprons and knit by the television. They were both plush and grizzled, unpretentious, surely satisfied by their lot. I imagined the big crystal jars on their end tables filled with hard candy, homemade afghans draped over their chairs and sofas, a cherished little dog. I thought of them in the evenings, both of them widows, home alone, heating up supper, thinking as they waited for their food, of me. They would both be overwhelmed and saddened by the case. They wouldn't know what to think. They would sit at the table over their beef stew, thinking not of the words of the experts or of any of the witnesses, but of me and the single question: did she do it? Could that girl with the handsome husband in the back have done it? On Thursday, Susan Dirks called Dr. Eugene Bailey, a psychologist from the University of Wisconsin. He was a frail-looking man with small round glasses, thinning red hair, and a cyst on the bald part of his head. Rafferty had never seen him in court before. He had told me at the break that he nearly felt sorry for the professor.
The guys Dirks usually haul in must be out of town. I can't imagine how she dragged this poor mole away from his books, unless he's a relation, a brother-in-law. I bet he's been in the tower for the last 40 years, going back and forth on the path between his office and the lecture hall. I felt like asking him if we should call his mother, that we permitted our witnesses to sit on their mother's laps.
Dirks questioned Dr. Bailey primarily about post-traumatic stress syndrome. There was the litany: bedwetting, aggressive behaviors, nightmares, detachment from others, recurrent and intrusive recollections of the event. By now, so many of the questions seemed formulaic that I felt that I could have asked them myself.
Dr. Bailey, she said, you have told us that Robbie Mackesy suffers from PTSS. Have you formed an opinion based upon your training and experience and based upon your evaluation of the child to within a reasonable degree of psychological certainty as to the cause of PTSS?
Yes, I have.
And what is that opinion?
Again, I watched Betty and Grace, the Greek god, the dairyman, the intellectual woman, while Dr. Bailey declared that I had both physically and sexually abused Robbie Mackesy. My favorite jurors had settled into their duty. Some of them rocked a little in their comfortable chairs. They were all listening, but their faces were placid, unruffled. They were saving their judgment, their emotion, for the deliberation, perhaps. I couldn't have begun to say what any of them was thinking of Dr. Eugene Bailey's partially audible, careful testimony. Rafferty began his cross-examination by saying, "Let me ask you, Dr. Bailey, about the so-called trauma of the primal scene. By the primal scene, I am referring to sexual intercourse. The orthodox psychoanalytic notion, I believe, is this. A child who witnesses the primal scene is deeply traumatized. Is that correct?" Dr. Bailey was wearing a turtleneck and sucking on lozenges. It was good to know that his voice may not normally have been so thin and reedy.
"That is Freud's general interpretation, yes," he answered.
"When a child witnesses the primal scene, does he not frequently interpret sexual intercourse as a cruel, destructive act?"
"That is one of the possible misinterpretations on the child's part. The psychic content will vary according to the child's age and previous history."
"Uh-huh. But what is almost always present in the young child, the 4-, 5-, 6-year-old who witnesses intercourse, is the linking together of sex and danger. Is that not true?"
"The content varies according to the details that have been witnessed."
"But if a young child does witness the act, it is possible for that child to be traumatized?"
"Yes."
"Traumatized to the degree that he may develop subsequent neurosis?"
"Freudian scholars would certainly agree with that statement."
"Other psychoanalysts, not only Freud, but Rohim and Ferenczi, for example, talk about the identification with the mother, who represents the support of the child, and the child's inability to deal with the mother's relation to other objects, such as the father. Ferenczi says, if I recall correctly, that the child is overwhelmed by emotions that he cannot yet organize when he witnesses the primal scene. Is that a reasonable statement?"
"Reasonable, yes."
"We all understand that there is enough literature on this subject to more than fill this courthouse. Would you be so kind as to briefly tell us what effect the primal scene has on a young child, in your view?"
Dr. Bailey cleared his throat. "When a child sees that his parents cannot transcend the body in their most intimate relations, the child naturally has anxiety. The child is in the process himself of trying to work out the problem of the body, trying to overcome the horror of the body.
It wasn't difficult to understand why Dr. Bailey could speak to the horror of the body when his own form, his sunken chest, his slim waist that required a belt for which he likely had to make extra holes, might alone have caused him plenty of trauma and subsequent neurosis. I liked Dr. Bailey, felt his sensitivity, his probable fondness for moss and lichens, wildflowers, Debussy. If the child then sees the parents in conjugal relations, he was saying, he can well feel betrayed by them. He sees the adults keeping the relationship, an obviously special, deep relationship of the body, away from the child, in fact, denying it to him. The child will undoubtedly experience alarm and confusion. But as I said before, the trauma is dependent on what he witnesses, how much, how long, and so forth and so on. Is it possible, Dr. Bailey? Rafferty said, walking along the jury box and tapping it with his pen as if he meant to wake them up. Is it possible that when a child sees his parents having sex, he may feel betrayed?
I believe I just said so, yes.
What would you say are typical reactions to betrayal? If a person feels that he has been betrayed, how might he act in general?
Well, I'd say that typical responses might include anger, despair, perhaps vengeful feelings.
And could that feeling of betrayal in a child make him exhibit some of the symptoms of PTSS that we've been talking about?
Hypothetically, yes.
Did you ask Robbie if he'd witnessed the primal scene?
No, I didn't.
And yet you just said that a child who sees the sex act may exhibit some of the symptoms of PTSS, did you not?
We are speaking hypothetically.
So, you didn't think it necessary to ask a child who has sexual knowledge and symptoms of PTSS if he had witnessed the primal scene?
Not in this case, no.
And from your description of the primal scene, am I correct that this is usually presumed to be the sexual act between the child's parents?
That's the presumption.
Now, doctor, if that child were to witness the primal scene, but let us imagine that the sexual act was a violent one, involving bondage or whipping, would it be fair to say that this could cause an even more severe reaction?
Yes, that's fair.
And suppose further, if you would, that this scene is not only violent, but is between the child's mother and a veritable stranger, not rape, but a man who does not know or care to know anything about his paramour's child. Couldn't that result in even more pronounced symptoms of PTSS?
Undoubtedly.
You stated in your report that Robbie's nightmares, his acting out, his regressive behavior, were pronounced symptoms of PTSS, did you not?
If it's in the report, then I did.
You stated in your report and in your testimony that Robbie had pronounced symptoms of PTSS.
Yes, as a result of...
That will be all my questions, Your Honor. The last person to testify for the prosecution was Officer Melby. He was put at the end so that the jury would be left with my own words, my admission, the "I hurt everybody" line. It began to snow while he described my conduct at the school board meeting. Susan Dirks asked him several different questions about my admission, so that he kept repeating the incriminating sentence. I watched the flakes come sifting down past the windows. It was going to be Christmas soon. Dan and Teresa had only two Christmases with Lizzie. There would be milestones every year. The day of the drowning. The day of her death. Christmas. Easter. Her birthday. The years couldn't ever simply go forward because of the cycle that would keep them anchored in the past. The day of the drowning. The day of her death. Christmas. Easter. Her birthday. I didn't dare think about Christmas, about where I might be. I had thought that I should buy a few things in case I wasn't with the family, so that Howard wouldn't have to brave the mall. If I'd been fanciful, I might have felt Lizzie's presence because of the snow. I might have thought it was her way of being with us, assuring us with the soft white cover. I couldn't listen anymore, and Howard had to tell me on the way home that he thought Rafferty had sufficiently clouded Melby's case. Howard didn't sound entirely convincing. He said that Rafferty had forced the officer to admit that he hadn't investigated any other explanations or any other possible suspects. Rafferty had moved for a directed verdict at the end of Dirks's case for some technical reason I didn't want to understand. He knew the judge would deny it, but it would be necessary to have made the motion in the event of an appeal. We stopped at the hardware store outside of Spring Grove and bought two plastic green sleds. It was Thursday, and we were set free until Monday, sent out into our new world like moonwalkers on a tether. After dinner, we turned on the spotlight outside, and we all took turns sliding down our driveway into the empty street. Chapter 21. The teacher from Robbie's preschool, Rafferty's first witness on Monday, was a tall, graceful woman named Linda Gildner. Her brown hair was done up in a French braid with pretty, tightly curled tendrils framing her face. She was wearing a navy dress with a scoop neck and a dropped waist, speckled all over with light blue birds. Howard, during the break, in a moment of surprising levity, said that she looked like a Disney version of the caretaker, the sweet nanny who had magical powers. I said that she could probably make the birds in her own dress come to life and fly around to amuse her charges. He snorted, and his lips widened. Although as a family we hadn't gone anywhere over the weekend, he had disappeared for several hours Saturday afternoon with the car. I suspect he had driven to the farm. It had been a long, quiet 2 days, and the girls had bickered quite a bit. Although our joke wasn't too funny, it nonetheless gave me a sense of relief. It was communion of sorts. Howard and I had been in a holding pattern, like two aircraft circling each other, around and around in the fog, the heavy weather preventing us from landing or straying from our loops. Linda Gildner spoke about Robbie as if she didn't want to mention his bad behavior, that it wasn't her nature to squeal on people, but of course she had sworn to tell the truth and must please the court. Rafferty managed to act as if he was also suffering throughout, as she quietly explained that Robbie had been a belligerent, troubled child 2 and 3 years before, and that her staff had repeatedly suggested that the Mackesys have him evaluated. Rafferty nodded periodically and then shook his head slightly, saddened, shocked, that one so young had gone awry. I thought to myself, oh, but Robbie wasn't that bad. Truly, he wasn't so awful. They were drawing him as a budding psychopath based on his performance at preschool. It disturbed me that both the Gildners and Rafferty belonged to the yacht club and had spent vacations boating together. Linda told the court that even at the ages of 3 and 4, Robbie had had a pattern of lying, and not lying about isolated things here and there, as all young children will, but deliberately telling falsehoods so that others would get into trouble. He lied to place blame elsewhere, and while that's not an unusual practice in 3 or 4-year-olds, Robbie, she said, had carried the tendency to extremes. He was a bright boy, sensitive to group dynamics, further along cognitively, she thought, than other 3-year-olds in terms of knowing how to manipulate an adult. I wondered if it was evident only to me what gestures and phrases Rafferty had suggested she use in her testimony. When Robbie had held a little girl's arm on the jungle gym and wouldn't let go, so that the arm was broken, in full view of his teachers, Linda said that he vigorously denied having done so. He lied in the face of reality, she added, pursing her lips and nodding. He hadn't been withdrawn or frightened, the way so many other children would have been when he was gently questioned about the incident. He stormed and shouted, blaming the other boys, calling them by name, saying that they all had been on the jungle gym with him, that everyone but himself had twisted her arm. It was one thing to be on trial as an adult, to have every past act come bubbling up and held to the light as a misdeed, every poor judgment fitting so nicely into the desired profile. But it was altogether different, shameful, to do the same for a boy of 6. I should have been grateful for Linda Gildner, but I thought she rang false, coached to death, exaggerating the few naughty pranks that Robbie had pulled as a 3-year-old. Susan Dirks, in her cross-examination, asked why Robbie had been allowed to break a girl's arm when the teachers were looking on. "That sounds like negligence to me," Dirks said quickly, before Rafferty protested. "How many teachers were watching while the girl's arm was broken?"
3.
3 teachers standing by while a girl broke her arm on the jungle gym? Later, Dirks said, "In your testimony, you spoke about the cognitive abilities of Robbie Mackesy at 3 years of age. Do you have your doctorate in psychology?"
"No, I don't, but I..."
"Do you have, at the very least, a master's in social work?"
"No, but I..."
"A degree in education, Mrs. Gildner, hardly qualifies you to speak with authority about childhood psychology. Isn't it true that it is normal for a 3-year-old to lie to get out of trouble?"
"Yes, but I said..."
"You said that he had a pattern of lying, Mrs. Gildner, and yet you've only mentioned one incident."
I remember that he had a pattern of lying, but now, with the years passing and all the children I see, I can't tell you more about that. I mean, children lie about little things, about toys and food, so that for me to bring back a specific..."
"You don't remember other incidents?"
"Well, I know they happened, but like I said..."
When we were leaving the courtroom after her testimony, Rafferty whispered to me, "Don't look so glum."
"She was a disaster," I said.
"No, no, she wasn't at all. The jury will remember how mild she was, and that Dirks preyed upon her. They'll remember that Robbie broke a kid's arm when he was 3.
"Did he really do that?"
Rafferty's chin shot down to his chest, and he looked severely up at me over his glasses. "I don't think the boy is as bad as you've made him out to be," I said. "I'm not sure it happened like that." He drew me to him as we walked down the hall. "This is stressful," he said. He was still whispering, but his hold was firm. The pressure from his fingertips on my arm was almost painful. "You have to understand that I would never put a witness on to lie. Never. And it's not going to do you much good at this juncture to start feeling sorry for Robbie. It's admirable, but beside the point right about now. Go get yourself a drink and let's keep calm." I heard Dichette, heard her loud and clear, her voice nearly strong enough to make my own tongue move. She was saying, "I'd walk down the street looking at you, Mr. Rafferty, thinking you was a smart-ass lawyer. But you nothing but some kind of pop-eyed, mangy, half-breed dog, ripping that boy limb from limb, chewing him up, spitting him out, and then you expect us to study what's all over the floor and say, 'Yes, sir, that pile of shit is a boy.'" That first afternoon, Rafferty called James Grinder Perkins. He worked as an office manager at the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison, overseeing those who process beef and pork into hot dogs. He was a fine-boned man, not much taller than Mrs. Mackesy. He had expensive-looking hair, layered and conditioned and blown dry, and blue wire-rimmed glasses. No one around Prairie Center, except Dan, wore skinny ties and designer glasses. Shortly after he took the stand, the judge summoned Rafferty and Dirks into his chamber. Howard and I waited out in the hall. He was trying to study his vehicle registration handbook so that he might soon advance to team captain, and I looked out the window wondering about the girls across the street in the jail. Rafferty had expected that the judge would ask for an offer of proof that his witness was not collateral to the case, that the witness would provide relevant information. Howard was unable to stop jiggling his foot, what for him could pass as hysterics. I had to say his name 3 or 4 times before he looked away from his manual. "I just wonder," he said after a while. "I just wonder what makes Rafferty think the judge is going to take our side." Judge Peterson promised when he took office that he would treat those who appeared before him with fairness and impartiality, I said. "Oh, please." He had his hand at his throat. "You sound like you're reciting a scout's oath." "There is still hope," I said. He sighed. "What I find hard to believe is that she actually dated a man who makes hot dogs. Someone called Grinder. Did Rafferty assume she'd fall for someone who made hot dogs and brats? Did he go to the Oscar Mayer plant and ask all the workers if they'd gone out with her? Why does it have to be hot dogs? Why couldn't she go out with someone who works for the Sierra Club?" "Howard, I don't know," I said. "He works in an office anyway. Rafferty said he wasn't the first choice, that there was some other boyfriend, a real piece of work, who the neighbor lady saw. At least Grinder's not down on the line, pulling the wieners out of a machine. He's not some big, beefy Neanderthal guy who can't speak in complete sentences and wears a loincloth. I was surprised that he's a white-collar worker, not some awful redneck." I heard Dyschette again, talking to me this time. "You always saying things like you think you God looking down at the half-ass work you made, like you don't like nothing you spent all that time making. You always sizing people up and you don't know shit about them, girl. You don't know shit." "Who knows?" I said. "Who knows about any of them?" When Rafferty and Dirks and Judge Peterson reappeared, the trial resumed. Jim Perkins wasn't harsh or vulgar in appearance. He was a quiet, well-mannered, well-dressed citizen. It would have been easier for the jury to understand him if he'd seemed stupid or coarse. Later, Rafferty articulated so well what came across about Perkins, what the jury, with a bit of luck, may have perceived and found distasteful beyond the prurient details of his sex life. "Did you notice," Rafferty asked me, "how earnest Perkins was about his pleasures? He takes himself very seriously. He didn't have any qualms about getting up in front of us to tell us about his mastery. And he made it clear that his recreation was his constitutional right and that he was proud of his potency. Perkins wasn't my first choice, but he did all right. He was better for us than I'd hoped." "Did you usually stay the night at Carol Mackesy's?" Rafferty asked him during the questioning. "Maybe once or twice, not usually." "Where was Robbie when you had your trysts at her house?" "He wasn't around." "Do you know where he'd been sent?" "We didn't talk about him." "He wasn't a concern?" "He was hers." "I see. So you were not involved in her personal life?" "That's right." "And if Robbie had been around, you might not have known it." "I never thought about it.
I didn't know she had a kid until pretty near the end.
Did you meet him?
I saw him a couple of times.
Did you see him at the house?
Yes.
Were you ever at the house for a social visit?
Ah, we always met for a purpose.
For what purpose?
What I'd advertise for.
So you came to the house for sex?
Correct.
And you saw Robbie a couple of times, you said?
We had a meal afterward a few times, and he showed up.
Where had he been?
A friend's.
Who told you he'd been at a friend's house?
I assumed it, I guess. She didn't say.
Robbie showed up, you said. He was suddenly just there in the kitchen to eat the meal?
As I said, I didn't think about him.
Howard was silent on the way home that night. It's one thing to be in a car with someone who is quiet, and another to be with someone who is silent. I couldn't remember the last time I'd seen him look anything but grim. I made a few observations along the way. I wondered what it meant that Dirks hadn't chosen to cross-examine Grinder. I thought Howard might answer, but he got out of the car when we pulled into the driveway and walked into the house, shutting the door before I got there.
This ends Disc 14.